Good evening, beautiful people. We have a full hour of bliss ahead of us. Now, this is Dante's Old South, and I'm your host, Clifford Brooks. And I'm taking you on an adventure that includes two poets and one accidental Buddhist. Now, if you don't think that's enough, we have the music of Lettuce and Jump Little Children to help us along this journey. And if you have any blues instrumentals, it is from the incomparable Justin Johnson. Now, before I jump into the first interview, let me give a big thank you to NPR and WUTC, the Woodbridge Inn, Meadowbrook Inn, the Red Phone Booth, and Mr. Classics Haberdashery. Now, let's take a second to talk about the guys that make this show happen all together. And that be Richard Winham and Michael Amade. Now, let's get into the first song of the evening, which is Chip in a Bottle by Jump Little Children.
Making it rain, shelter my apologies. And up now we have poet, novelist, essayist, and educator, David Armand. David, how are you doing?
Good. Good to see you, or hear you in this case.
Well, it's wonderful to sit with you and to, you know, knock this out of the park with a high note. You were planning to be a rock star, but that didn't quite work out. How did music get you into and out of poetry, boss?
Well, when I was a teenager, like probably 60% of the guys I went to school with, you know, you picked up a guitar and, you know, that was in the 90s, you know, Nirvana was out, Pearl Jam, you know, and I saw those guys and I thought, man, I want to be like that guy, you know? And so I started learning how to play the guitar and started a band and, you know, sort of punk band, you know, because that's the easiest, you know, at least you learn about 3 or 4 chords and you can kind of make do. And, you know, so we played at like some parties and stuff. And, but it wasn't like a phase or anything. So I kept doing it and getting better. And then I started playing bass and, mainly just because it seemed like a lot of bands always needed bass players, you know? And so I got really into bass and, we made some demos and some recordings and played some little shows and stuff, but you know, it started to occur to me when it got to be like in my early 20s. Yeah, this is probably about as far as I can go with this, you know, unless I just want to be, you know, that guy who's, you know, like in his 60s, you know, playing at the little bars downtown or whatever. And I mean, that's great, but I just thought, yeah, I don't think I can be that guy. So, you know, I was in college and I, I've always been interested in, you know, writing and reading and that sort of thing. So I started taking poetry classes and, the guy who I studied under, the first guy I studied under, Jack Bedell, was in this like hard rock band, Nail Boss. And I had actually seen them play when I was like this skater kid in high school. And, so I thought, well, that's so cool. Like this dude's, you know, in this hard rock band, he's got like long hair and stuff. And he's like writing these poems about Louisiana. And so all of a sudden something just kind of clicked like, yeah, you can kind of do both of these things or you can make one become the other, you know? And of course, poetry is very musical. So that's kind of how that evolved, I guess. You know, I still tinker around with a guitar and all that occasionally, but, not as much. And those dreams have died of and being a rock star, but, it was fun when it lasted.
Jack Bedell, he is one of my best friends in the world, and I had no idea you even knew him. He's going to be on the AWP board with us, man, real soon. Serendipity, dude. But back in, I big deep dive back into. I'm not going to let this rock and roll dream die, or at least not yet. An important note that I wanted people to take from this: you looked that dream in the face, appreciated it, loved it, and said, "Well, that's not going to happen. I'm going to shift over here and do something like that." But not quite. You know what? This makes me happy. There's a little piece there where you came to peace with what couldn't be for what could be. What was that like? How did you pull it off?
It happened, I think, just so sort of organically that it did. It wasn't like, you know, on Tuesday I was like, I'm going to be a rock star in 5 years, and then on Wednesday I was like, okay, I'm going to be a poet. It kind of just like I sort of slid out of one into the other, and you know, probably there was some part in the back of my mind that still thought, yeah, you know, because I was still kind of playing around in bands and stuff, and I thought, you know, you just don't know, you the right person could hear our song, and we, you know, and so I was kind of doing both at first, and then I just, the craft of writing became so important to me that I just felt like I had to put the music on the back burner because I felt like I couldn't like completely devote myself to those two things and give them both what they deserved at the same time, you know. So, but that just is a testament, I guess, to just how much like poetry and writing means to me, is that I didn't want to like split it with anything else. It had to be all this or all that.
Exactly. you can't serve two gods. Or is it, at least they won't let you, man. You know? Yeah. And so as we, you know, you switch gears, man, you're in college, you're fresh out of college. You've had some odd jobs to keep it together while this one worked out. I want to know about those, dude, the nitty gritty of it.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, I, when I first had my first book come out, the editor of that press, Texas Free Press, he said, yeah, I mean, need you to send me a little bio, you know? So I was going through this, like this weird kind of like Cormac McCarthy phase or something. And I thought, well, yeah, I want to be this real like enigmatic. So I sent him a bio and it just said, David Armand lives in Louisiana with his wife and children. And he emailed me back. He's like, that's a little bit skimpy, man. You need to give me a little bit more than that. So then I started thinking, you know, yeah, all these writer bios that I usually read, it says, you know, they have their MFA from here and their PhD from here. And they've, you know, been a Stegner fellow and a, you know, this and that, which is great. But I thought, I didn't do all that stuff. You know, at that time I didn't have an MFA or anything. And so I thought, well, I'll put what, you know, I've seen other people. It's like William Gay's a writer I like a lot. He was never embarrassed to say he was a drywall hanger for most of his life before he started writing. And I always thought that was cool, you know? So I had hung drywall too in high school. And so I kind of just made my bio like, okay, so here's the weird jobs I've had. And so, yeah, I was in high school. I moved out of my house when I was like 16, you know, because I was just, you know, just having issues at home. So I moved out and I moved in with this guy who had his own drywall business. And so I lived with him for a few weeks and did that. And then not long after that, I went to a temp agency because, I mean, it's hard to find. I was still in high school, but, you know, I had like hair down past my shoulders and greasy hair and torn up jeans and stuff. You know, you walk into a place for a job interview, it's like, come on, man. You know, like people. So like I went to a temp agency and they said, so this is what we got. You know, there's this factory that they're hiring people to work to, not even in the night overnight shift, but it was like from 4 to 12:30 in the morning, you know, and you basically stand in front of like this press and you print flags. Like, so you take this piece of white material that whatever flags are made out of, and then you just press down this machine and it prints a design on it, and you do that for 8 hours one after it. But the thing is, you have to do it really fast because they count them at the end of your shift. If you don't meet your quota, you know, they lay you off. And so I did that for a while, and then I thought I had really hit it big because I got a telemarketing job and it was like in an office and I could sit in a chair and I didn't have to sweat and get dirty and I could go home in like the same clothes that I left in. And that was another really interesting because the people that would, I didn't have to call them. So I wasn't like selling stuff. It was people calling to order stuff for catalogs.
Yeah.
And I would just hear the strangest stories and not even thinking at the time, yeah, one day I'm gonna write about all this stuff, you know. And I wasn't like, I was just trying to get a paycheck, you know. But it turned out that I ended up writing about a lot of those experiences, and it's kind of worked out for me, you know. And I, you know, kind of tell people sometimes, you know, now kids say it all the time about the gap year after, you know, I took a gap 2.5 years after high school. And that's when I did all that. So I, you know, I was a dishwasher. I mean, I did all kinds of stuff. And, but that, when I finally went to school, like college, like I was like, it like right in front of me, it was like, okay, so I can get up and go to class. I don't want to go, but I'm going to go because if I don't, I know it's waiting for me on the other side. It's like going back in that hot room, washing dishes or pressing flags down. So it kept me going. And then when I started studying writing, and my teachers would tell me stuff like, yeah, you know, it was, of course, now this is kind of fallen out of fashion, but back then it was still the thing to say is like, write what you know, you know. And so I was taught that, and so I started writing about all that stuff. And then I realized, well, people actually are kind of interested in reading about these weird little jobs, you know. So it wasn't fun when I was doing it, but I don't regret it now because it's, you know, it's helped me in a lot of ways. And also, I like the idea of telling people you don't necessarily have to go down this path where you make all the good test scores and get to the best college and study with the best people to become successful at you know, writing or publishing or whatever. So I've kept it on. My bio hasn't really changed much since 2010 when I first sent that one to Texas Review back then with my first book.
It's cool, man. Take a step back. Again, this interests me a lot as far as how we find ourselves and place in what we write. You were adopted, and did not dig too deep into it when you moved out when you were 16. Finding yourself in words to deal with that. How does that work on your mind, and how did words find their way out of that?
Yes. Yeah, so that, you know, I mean, I when I was two, I was adopted by my aunt and uncle, and my mother, my biological mother, she's schizophrenic, or was, she passed away a couple of years ago, but so she couldn't raise me, and she tried, you know, for the first couple of years as best as she could. And her sister, you know, saw that, you know, that just couldn't work long term. And so she and her husband, who was my uncle, they adopted me. And so they always told me, you know, that I was adopted, and they had two kids of their own. So those were my cousins who became my brother and sister. But it was weird because the house that I was adopted into, they didn't have books. There were no books. You know, my dad or stepdad, I still refer to him as my dad. But, you know, he was technically was my stepdad. His pastime was watching movies. Like, you know, he would just sit around and watch like Lethal Weapon and Rocky Five and, you know, all those action movies and stuff.
Yeah.
And I grew up watching all that stuff with him, you know, but there were no books. And there was no like real culture, unless you consider those kind of movies culture, but then I guess they are to an extent. But I always had this kind of interest in books and in reading and even writing. Even at a young age, I wrote stuff. And later I learned that I got that from my mother, because she was really interested in that. I didn't know that until I got a lot older and met her. I met her when I was 20 for the first time. And so that kind of, you know, the whole nature versus nurture debate, you know, I think that's just like my nature, that I, you know, what I got from her was my love for words and language. And then on a sort of a psychological note, I think, you know, cause I've thought about this a lot, you know, like and I read a book one time that, was about an adoptee. It was a fictional book. It was, you know, it was a novel, but, it said something, it seemed real profound at the time, and I probably will misquote it terribly, but something about the orphan's need to be accepted, to belong. And, you know, I don't think of myself as an orphan necessarily, but technically I guess I am or was. And so I started looking at, and that's probably why I started getting into music too. It's like this, not because I wanted attention, but it felt like if I can do this well, then I'll be accepted by somebody, and whoever that is, I don't know. And maybe it doesn't even matter. And so then later on when I started writing, it became the same thing, because people ask like, well, why do you do this? And it's not like for money, obviously, or like fame, but more like, I think I do have this like psychological need just for like acceptance or love, you know? And I feel like, well, this is the way I can get it. And it's futile, because, you know, it never ever like gets to that point where it's like, okay, now I finally got that thing that's missing, you know, that unconditional acceptance. But maybe other people feel that way too, even if they're not adopted. I don't know, but I feel like I'm always striving for that, and that's what keeps me going, though, you know. So I took something that some people could perceive as negative and maybe turned it into something that's good. I don't know.
That's exactly what you did. And to go back over your accolades, man, you're an award winner, bro. And you write poetry, you're a novelist and essayist, and you're an educator. That's a lot of hats to wear, man. How do we find your books? Tell us a little bit about them and where we can pick them up.
Well, most local bookstores around where I live in Louisiana carry them, or, you know, like the independent bookstores, you know, like Octavia Books in New Orleans, Garden District Books. But obviously the easiest place to find them is on Amazon or the publisher's websites, you know. So Texas Review Press, they published four of my books now, I think. They published my first novel, second novel, a memoir, and then they published my fourth novel. My third novel was published by a different press, but that's so Texas Review Press. If you people want to directly support the press, that's a great place to go. It's just, you know, Google Texas Review and you can find a way to order them through them. And then my third novel, The Gorge, was published by Southeast Missouri State University Press. And I say that slowly because it's kind of a mouthful, but they're another a university press who's been great to work with. And so again, you know, I think it's always best to just to go directly to the source for the books. It's not as easy, of course, as clicking on Amazon, you know, where you can get it. But I think the press and I, you know, I appreciate sending people that way. So Southeast Missouri State, and then my two poetry chapbooks. Two poetry chapbooks were published by Blue Horse Press out of California, which is a great little press. And you can go to the same thing. You can go, they published the San Pedro River Review also. And you can go to their website and order those chapbooks. And then my latest book, The Evangelist, that just came out earlier this month, was published by Mercer University Press out of Georgia. And so same thing. I mean, you go to their website and order directly from them. But the reality is I think most people probably just go to Amazon, type David Armand in there and pull them all up and just put them in their cart and go about their day. But, you know, if you want to go straight to the press, I know that they would appreciate it.
All right, man, before we let you go, you have something brand new, never before heard, that you're going to read for us, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So I have a kind of an interesting poem that that's always a difficult thing too about putting a collection together, is figuring out what belongs in there and what doesn't belong in there. And this one was a poem I liked, I was happy with, but it just didn't quite fit with the other poems that are in The Evangelist. Even though this one does talk about music and stuff, because The Evangelist, I didn't mention, you know, the evangelist that I'm sort of referring to is Elvis, you know, so there are a lot of Elvis poems that I've written, but I don't know, this one somehow just didn't quite make it. So, but it's still a poem I'm happy with, and it'll show up somewhere, I'm sure, one day. But it's called School. It was Friday night, the possibilities of the weekend spooling out before us with that sense of excitement you can only have at 17. We had each taken two hits of acid, little white squares of paper placed on our tongues like communion wafers, and were waiting for the effects to kick in. We listened to music we thought might spur it on quicker, Jimi Hendrix, Pink Floyd, The Doors, but it came on slow, sap-like, and easing up our spinal cords until we erupted first into laughter and then into introspection, considering the flakes of tobacco in our cigarettes as they cracked and popped and hissed under our lighter's wavering flames. It didn't take long before we were bored with the music and the lava lamp and the blacklight posters of Bob Marley and the Grateful Dead. So we decided to take a walk through the woods, where the ground appeared to be covered with a large net made of black strings creeping up the sides of trees and into the branches overhead, where they draped down like cobwebs and brushed at our arms and necks. The leaves seemed to thrum with energy. You could hear it, almost see it vibrating in a slow, steady pulse, a string pulled taut, then plucked, leaving an image of itself as it came back to its rightful place. The ends of our cigarettes seemed to light the way forward until we were standing in a sloping field of tall, wet grass just behind the football stadium where we went to school. It was dark, the game from earlier that night having already ended hours ago. And so we walked out past the bleachers and onto the grass where we lay down and felt its smooth itch on our sweat-dampened skin. Things devolved from there. I remember a golf cart pushing one another in it since we couldn't get it to start, a freezer full of bags of ice like they have at convenience stores, and one of us climbing inside of it to cool off. Then the cop car, pointing its spotlight at us as we ran back into the woods, not knowing if what we had really seen, if we had really seen it there or not. Later, when that same cop car picked us up on the side of the road, his blue lights flashing across our faces as we tried to talk our way out of trouble, we knew it had been real, all of it. But it would be many nights later when we had finally realized how stupid we had always been and how lucky we are now.
That's fire, man. That's fire.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, man. David Armand, poet, novelist, essayist, and educator. Please follow him. Tell us your website just before we let you go.
Yeah, it's www.davidarmandauthor.com.
All right, man. David, we're going to have you back real soon. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me, Cliff. It's been good talking to you.
And now it's time for Everything's Gonna Be All Right by Lettuce.
Now, on Dante's Old South, we have poet, dramatist, social activist, Kendall Hippolyte. Kendall, how are you doing?
I'm good. It's a good way to spend an evening and a night. I'm actually, I'm actually, I'm actually, I'm seeing it all I don't like the word sincerity, but I'm saying it truly. I'm looking forward to this conversation. Yeah, good vibe.
And I just hope that I can hold that vibe for you and not halfway through you say, Cliff, you know what? I've changed my mind. Time out. Time out. Look, I think that this, I have anything else in the world to do. I want to say up front, you know, it's I love this gig and I love to get to know people. And there's always these fascinating turns that I couldn't ever predict would happen in the show with you when we met, so to speak, about a week ago with the Bright Hill reading series. The presence that you bring, not to the screen, but it's one of the rare times that I felt in the Zoom, you know, era that I was in the room with you. When you read poetry, do you practice it before you start, or do you, how do you get your game face on?
Okay. I think my background in theater helps. So I don't necessarily practice it, except insofar as, I mean, I have timings to meet. If somebody tells me you've got 10 minutes to do this, it's my theater background. I time it beforehand and leave a leeway of 5-10 seconds, you know, to go beyond, and then give a rounded figure. But beyond that, I think it's more a matter of being, and that's theater and director talking. When a poem is being sounded, there is a who that is sounding the poem, and I don't mean necessarily Kendall Hiplett. So I can be sounding a poem, and I am not that I'll say this necessarily consciously to myself, but I can be sounding a poem, and the who that's sounding the poem is an uncle talking to a favorite but wayward child, or another time it might be the who might be someone who's really puzzled, anxious, over whatever, but maybe somehow convinced that there's a way to work this out. I'm just not sure what the way to work this out is. So I'm saying that I have to be there, and the I that has to be there, even for the same poem, is not necessarily going to be the same all the time. So, like, honestly, for me, Clifford, there are ways in which, you see, jazz musicians, they're more of a model for me than poets.
Yes.
Jazz musicians will take a melody, and it will be different every single, although it's recognizable, the melody is going to be different every time. So I kind of approach it like that. I don't try to set the cadences and that kind of thing beforehand. It's like, what I try to do is to be there in some way that I feel I need to be there inside of this poem, and I go from there. Yeah.
You are my spirit animal, man. I swear, the similarities that I feel in the community with poetry, like, anybody that knows me knows that it's not hard for me to talk. I'm really good at it. But the excitement I get to where I have to listen to you is, it's a constant, comfortable teacher. You bring it to the poetry, you bring it to the moment. And when you're describing being there for the poem, all roads don't lead back to me, but to talk about this, when I wanted to make sure my poetry was honest, and at first I thought, well, that sounds so, you know, fairy tale, but I have to make myself get there again in order to be. I mentioned this because I think this is what you were close to, what you were saying too, in the fact that, you know, when I did that and went back to that era, or, you know, when I went to that moment, I found out that there were some pains that I had gotten over, and that sitting in that moment, you know, and then being surprised that there was some stuff that I hadn't gotten over that I thought that it's the rawness that you have to be there in order for that poem to read in that moment and be true. And when you said be present to read it, you know, it's the performance of it, the theatrics of it, people, I'm not trying to be, you know, funny about this, but many folks, when they hear, do you want to go to a poetry reading? They're like, I thought you were my friend. No, why would you ever make me do that? You know, I've said that joke on the show before. They did not find it funny, and it made it weird after. Thank you so much. It's just, and I know why. And again, I'm not depreciating anybody, but there is a, thing that, so they get somebody. And early on, I went to the, a couple of readings that were kind of the same, but it's good for practice. And then I heard of someone said, you got to come hear this one person. Mm-hmm. And they got up there and just like you, not just like you do your own thing, but they made the story happen and they had their hands and they had, and they, you felt like you're a kid again.
Okay.
You know, the way there's a, the way that you, there are ways that people read poetry that is very off-putting. And at a volume where you can't, it can be a brilliant poem, but you feel like you're getting beat up. You know, and and it, with the way you read, I can't explain the way it feels. It feels like you sit within your poems, and we're not gonna be able to get away with this without you reading at least one of them. I can't keep talking it up and not let them have one. But before we even worry about that, you are a dramatist as well. And, you know, even more than that, with social activism, you too have all of it, or it seems like, from what I can tell, all of it overlaps. Like, it seems there's this organic movement. Tell me about that. Tell me about that, please.
Okay. I'm going to babble a little bit, right?
I just did. So good. Go ahead.
I'm going to babble a little bit. So I guess the one of the things that needs to be said, I'll say it now, is I've arrived at this kind of position and say from a number of different sources, walked a number of different roads to get there. But this thing that we call meaning in life, experiencing what meaning is. There are a lot of ways in which to approach it, but speaking, I guess, first off as a dramatist, I find what makes sense to me, well, this is a simple shorthand explanation, is that meaning happens when the head and the heart and, well, I'll call the hand, but I'm just meaning the sensory experience, when they come together, when intellect and emotion and the senses, because in theater that's so crucial. When intellect and emotion and the senses come together and agree, something has caused them to come in and agree. Because I think, honestly, Clifford, in normal everyday life, we have to do so much hiding, so much pretending, so much saying something but not really feeling it, or you're feeling something but you can't actually say it, you know, and you got to hold your body down from expressing, you know. Mm-hmm. And theater is wonderful to me because theater really asks you to throw all that aside and let everything come together, and when that happens, to me, is when you experience what I think of as meaning, you know.
Right.
So that's in a broad kind of way. I know whether I'm directing a play or I'm coaching actors or something, I'm reading a poem. What I'm hoping for, what I'm wanting to, is that somewhere within this, whether it's at the end of it or somewhere early on and then carries through, that persons will experience meaning, and not just only that persons will experience it, that I myself will experience it. You said to early on something about being inside of the words. That's necessary. I need to be inside of the words for the possibility of that meaning to happen. Okay, so that said, and that kind of like throw that aside, and when you talk about the poet and dramatist and social activist thing overlapping, because Lynn asked me something that that in a way, in my response to it, I know I'm talking, what I'm going to talk about now, was kind of trying to deal with that, which is this, that I came to my sense of what an artist is, not just a poet, of what an artist is in 1970s Jamaica. And 1970s Jamaica, well, 70s all over the world was the 70s. 1970s Jamaica was was a real was I can't find the words for it, but everything was happening then. Reggae music was beginning to come into its own then. A new kind of poetry was beginning to happen. Some of the kind of theater that was beginning to be created there. All of it was so unquestionably, or it was almost like taken for granted, that all of this had to have an effect on the society. All of this had to be part and parcel of creating a new society. That it can sound so kind of grand and portentous when you say it now, but really and truly, it just seemed perfectly normal. Like, why else do any of this except to break down the crap that's going on now, mm-hmm. and to help bring in something else? It's the only reason, really and truly. There's self-knowledge involved in doing that, and a quest for self-knowledge that's involved in doing that, because you need to have a better sense of who it is who's trying to break things down, who it is who's trying to help create something new. Because if you don't have that, then you can really mess things up. But I'm saying all this, right, about the overlapping of poet and that, for me, art in any form, any of the art forms, is inevitably to me about that tired phrase social change. That's uh-huh. for me, that's just a given. It's just a given. That's never ever changed for me. I've tried to refine my ideas about it and so on, but it's never ever changed. So I'm always talking to some body, some person, some audience, some in no matter. I hope I'm beginning to zero in on what you're raising.
What's better is that you give me an entire college course of wisdom and then say, well, I think that worked. You just moved me. I'm sitting here having to remind myself it's being recorded and not pick up a notebook. And I'm not saying it to be funny. It's people that are reading it, they're in their cars right now going, you're going to feel it. You're going to feel it. I promise you. Because when you gave that, when you gave the reading for Bright Hill, you could watch everybody hum together. And there's the smile there. I keep going back to when my grandmother, that safety you got when there's nothing that could get you, that the monsters and all the scary stuff that smile you get, where like, there's nothing in this world you got to worry about. That's a gift. I don't, there's gotta be some of that naturally, I think, born into you. And because there's, I never say it looks effortless, because that's silly. Everything takes effort, obviously. But the way that you're able to woo people honestly into these spaces, bringing the right amount of theatrics and and I love how you said that to read it slow enough that you can switch it up, that you can read the same poem. These are things taken just a little bit of a side road. These are things that I think should be in more classes for poets. Mm-hmm. That what really, I guess, when I'll go to, go to a lot of readings, you'll hear the words and that they're beautiful. You get, because the soul's still there, but when you don't give it, it's like being read by a speaking spell. I don't know if you remember those toys. It's this is a poem. And about marigolds. And I'm not making fun of anybody. Like I used to do, I get so nervous that I would be able to read a 7-page poem in like 1.2 seconds. And so everybody kind of felt like they were in a wind tunnel. And they were like, I think that was cool. And so I'm serious. I got some stories for y'all that are mainly more than that. The show does not shy away from the social change, and I love that idea about the meaning of a poem, that and again, this is just me kind of riffing on this, but there are poems that are, they're perfectly good, and I mean this, but they're what I call the window looker poems, where there's, and I think we've all got one that's not lazy, but it's a real good, you know, so here I am and I see a sparrow and it means this, and then I see it, and you know, the old man in me now is like, you're being lazy. You know, it's like, well, let me write this. I just let me look out here and just talk about what I see. you take that your social activism, it's never heavy in the regard that it pushes people away. It's you don't try to trick anybody, but it's so smooth that by the time I realize I've already got that energy of social change, like the energy that I can make things better. How do you do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess first thing, I don't know where this answer is going to go, but I mean, you're always writing, and I'm saying the word writing, whatever art form you're working with. I think if you're trying to be best you can, sincere to it and sincere to yourself, you're always writing about your inner life. So, but I mean, even when you're dealing with political events, political trends, that kind of thing, It's your reaction, your responses to those things is really what's, you know, that's really what you're delving into. And also, what you're trying to find out too, because, this has been said in so many different ways, but it's, you know, it bears saying again, it's true. So now you really do write so as to find out what you truly think and truly feel, honestly. I discovered this from quite early, because I kept a journal from the age of 12, and somewhere along the way it cemented for me that the journal is the one place where I must never lie. Better not to write anything than to write on a lie. Better not, you know, if what's in your mind trying to form, you figure you can't face it, then just don't put it down. A time hopefully will come when you can face it and the words will come, you know. So for me, so it's a place where, so I, for me, so it, be, it became just simply true that what I put down in the journal, however inarticulately, was the truth as I understood it then about myself.
Right.
So then but as part and parcel of that, as I grew into writing, and then tried to understand what writing in different forms of it really, what they really were. And that's a lifelong task, understanding those forms. That idea of, you're writing to find out. You're writing to probe yourself, what you truly think, what you truly feel. Because once it goes, you know, if you do end up publishing or putting it out in some way, once it goes out there, that's you out there. And did you really believe that? Did you really and truly believe that? Did you really truly think that? You might, you know, at the time, you know, 5 years later, you might change your mind. You might look back and say, yeah, all right, okay, that's, I believed it then. I see it differently now. But at the time, I really and truly believed it. I really and truly felt it. I really and truly thought it. Yeah, so I'm going round and round and round in a circle to make the simple, just make the simple point that you're always writing about your inner life. But thinking back again, and that's why I theater really kind of gave me a grounding and continues to give me a grounding in seeing, understanding how to try to connect with an audience, still stay where you are, but to connect with an audience, and to have the sense of when you're connecting and when you're not. Working with actors, you know, involves a lot of that. I'm not even sure I'm remembering exactly what you asked, but it's so when I said earlier on about that the meaning has to happen for me, for the I who is there at the time, and sounding the words, the meaning has to be happening there for I at the time when I'm sounding out the words, for that meaning to also happen or stand a chance of happening with an audience. For me, again, that simple truth, the two things are, it's a current. And theater teaches that. Theater is life currents going from actors out to the audience and the audience sending the current back. And, you know, and you can sense when that's there. You can sense when the current is there and when it's not. You know, you can be blindfolded and still sense when it's there or not. You know?
Yeah, Kendall Hippolyte, man, we're going to have you back real soon, man, because this, you are wisdom. You are wisdom, man. Thank you so much. We'll have you back soon, man.
Yeah, all right.
Now let's take a second to soak in Insta Classic by Les. Next up on Dante, we have novelist, educator, and a profoundly positive influence in my life, Mr. Dinty. Dinty, how are you?
I'm doing really well.
I'm going to begin at the beginning. Early in the 2000s, I read your book, The Accidental Buddhist, and it is, without hesitation or second thought, the reason that my life has the calm in it today, the way that you described it. The title is what caught me immediately, because I always been kind of interested in the idea, but the way that you said that the idea of even the Zen of the accidental Buddhist and being there without it being in the plan. Let's start by you telling us about that book and its impetus and how it still relates and works in your life.
I began the book, and that's where the accidental comes from, as sort of a recovered journalist. But I thought I was going to write an informational book about why Buddhism, you know, which remains an ancient faith practice, an arcane and Asian. It's not a good fit for America, or at least that's what I thought back then. Right. But it was starting to really spread, not just New York and San Francisco, where you'd expect to find Buddhist monasteries and Buddhist retreat centers, but into Iowa and West Virginia and Illinois and Atlanta. And it just seemed like everybody was talking about mindfulness and breathing, both of which come, you know, from, not breathing comes from, we all breathe, but the idea of centered breathing, you know, comes from the Asian influences that Buddhism is part of. So I went out and started exploring, like, who are these Tibetan Buddhists in Atlanta? Who are these Theravadan Buddhists in West Virginia? And it kind of got hold of me. Not that I wasn't interested. I mean, I like many people, felt drawn to the very shallow idea that I had of what Buddhism was. But the more I learned and the more I participated, it really got into my bones and into my blood and into my mind. And I found myself changed because of it. And then the book, The Accidental Buddhist, is that story.
How has that book, how the practice of meditation, finding that center breath, do you think that it changed, clarified, altered somehow the way that you wrote from that period on?
You know, I struggle with that, because so much of Buddhist teaching is non-attachment, you know, let go of things, don't cling to things. And, you know, and really most pursuits, but certainly a pursuit like writing is about stubbornness and clinging to it and going back to the desk every day. What I've done, and by the way, you know, for anybody listening, I'm still a lousy Buddhist. I'm still sort of struggling to make it work, but even if you do it poorly, it works. I think what I finally learned to do is sort of do a better job of letting go of what I can't control. So I can control how much effort I put into my writing. I can control learning the craft and getting better at figuring out how words on the page work. You know, it's, every sentence is a machine and every paragraph is a larger machine. Mm-hmm. But I can't control who, you know, I can't control fame. I can't control publishing. I can't control all the weird ways that publishing works and that books get lost and all of that. So, you know, I've let go of that to the best of my ability. And I just write because I have something I want to say.
It's why it sticks. And what also sticks in this show is Lynn Keeman, who is a return guest interviewer. Lynn, you have some specific things for Dinty too. Give us one or two of those questions.
Absolutely. First, welcome. I'm thrilled that you're here.
Oh, thank you.
No, thank you. We were talking before about some of the posts that you do on Facebook that are quotes from writers about writing. And I just want to say, I follow it regularly, and I know a lot of my writer friends follow it. But I'm also interested to see who else follows it. And those people are not necessarily writers. How did you decide to start doing that?
Oh, I decided to start doing that the way I've decided so many things, which is I didn't really decide. I just kind of started doing something, thinking, oh, this will last a week. And all of a sudden, you know, here I am all these years later. I think I've been doing it for more than 15 years, posting at least 5 days out of the week, a daily writing quote, or I try to expand into creativity quotes. I like to work some visual artists and choreographers in there too. You know, the feedback I started getting almost immediately from people saying, oh, I love waking up and looking at that. Oh, I needed to hear that one today, is why I keep doing it. There's also something that, not, you know, I hate to mention the dreaded Twitter because of all that's been going on with Twitter this past year, but it actually begins on Twitter. I post it on Twitter, and then I move it over to Facebook, the quote, you know, whoever I'm quoting that day. And there's something about having to find in a sentence or in two sentences the brevity of a Twitter post. Because yeah. You can talk forever about art, and certainly there's books and books and books about creativity and art. But I like finding something that's sort of essential that can say, and I forget now how many words you're allowed to use on Twitter. They tend to change it around, but or characters. But to be able to say something interesting about creativity in a small sentence or two, I'm drawn to that. I'm drawn to finding those. I'm drawn to thinking about those. I'm drawn to posting those on social media.
And some of them are very well-known people, and some of them are not, at least well-known to me. And I've sort of started off on a path and found new people to follow. And
that's wonderful. That's wonderful to know.
While we're on the subject of brevity, because you did say brevity.
Yes.
Can you talk about your magazine?
Yeah, Brevity is a magazine I've been publishing for 24 years now, which astonishes me. And like my Facebook experience, I started Brevity because I wanted to like learn how to do HTML. This was back in 1996, 97. I was just playing around. I never imagined I'd have a magazine that lasted 24 years, that had, you know, 10,000 visits per issue, that is dry, and it's all online. So we have readers across the globe, and we publish people from all, you know, well, I mean, English-speaking nations like India and throughout Europe, but, you know, there's English speakers everywhere. So we publish people from Africa, from India, from across Asia, from across Europe, from South America. It's a truly international magazine. It's short. Every piece is 750 words or fewer, and it's only nonfiction. So, memoir, lyric essay, anything true, but told in an artistic way.
In terms of, I know you've published one book called The Best of Brevity. Are you going to do more books on that subject?
I don't know. I suppose we could. It was hard to narrow down 24 years of essays that we published into one relatively short book and call it the best, but it was a fascinating endeavor. I'm wondering if maybe we could do sort of themed anthologies at some point. You know, we've had some wonderful pieces about grief. We've had some wonderful pieces about nature and the natural world. We've had amazing pieces about childhood and adolescence and, you know, the struggles of growing up in the world. So, you know, that's only so many hours in the day. If I had a staff of 20, I would call them right now and tell them to get started on it, but I don't.
Well, since we're talking about poetry, it begs now to ask you, have you ever dabbled in poetry?
Dabbling is the exact right word. I so much admire what poets do. I've gotten better over the years at reading poetry. I believe that not everything a poet does, but I mean, really, really good prose has rhythm, has imagery, has metaphor. Mm-hmm. even has sometimes internal rhyme and slant rhyme in the sentences, assonance and dissonance and alliteration. So I love playing with language, but for some reason, for me, it always ends up in prose. I published a prose poem in the Iowa Review many years ago.
Right.
I published some really odd little poems that were fun, but I think they were more funny than they were skillful in a Buddhist magazine around the time that Accidental Buddhist came out. But I'm not, I don't call myself a poet by any means, and I'm not good at it. I might have been if I put my efforts there, but I've obviously put my efforts into nonfiction prose.
I started out in prose. That was my bread and butter, and I would hear so many times, you know, if you study poetry, it would make you a better prose writer. And I kept thinking, that's somebody who likes poetry way too much, trying to pull me into it. And then I became a poet, and when I've now recently gone back to writing prose, it really has helped me be more aware of word. That's what I ask you. I can tell in real time, the first thing I noticed was word economy. I was much more aware of brevity, to use less to say more. And already kind of agreeing to that, is that something that you think is right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm also a teacher. Until recently, I taught at a university and would teach, a lot of young people. And they would come up to me every once in a while and say, do you think I have what it takes to be a writer? And I think they wanted me to tell them that I had enormous talent at the age of 19. But my answer, do you think I have what it takes to be a writer? My answer was always, do you like playing with words? If you really enjoy playing with words, you'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. If you just want to, be rich and famous and publish a book. Now that usually doesn't happen, but playing with words is what it's all about. And it's fascinating. It's fun to do. It's frustrating to do. It's magical sometimes, but that's what writing is.
And we are going to push the pause button right there, boss. That is exactly where this should end. But before we let you go, I want to say that the quality and the educational value of this small amount of time, this brief amount of time with you, has been a true honor to share. And I need to know, and the audience needs to know, how can we keep up with you online, and how can we buy your books?
I have a website, DintyWMoore.com. Dinty Moore is an odd name, but put that W in the middle. DintyWMoore.com. There's links to my books there. There's links to some of the teaching I'm doing both here and in the U.S. And I'm lucky enough to be teaching overseas this year in Costa Rica, Portugal, and Italy. So you can find all of that. And now I have to go update that website. But DintyWMoore.com.
Dinty, anytime that you want to come back on this show, the door is always open. And Lynn Keeman, yet again, you have enriched this moment in the beautiful way that you all.
Thanks to you both.
I want to thank every single one of you sitting down with me for the last hour to hear Dante's old self. I'm your host, Kurt Brooks. And you can find everything you want to know about me through www.cliffbrooks.com. If you want to know about the company behind all these shenanigans, look up www.southerncollectiveexperience.com. Above all, I want to thank you. Besides that, in a close second, I want to thank Richard Winham with WUTC and NPR for allowing this madness to happen, and Michael Amade keeping this mad train on the track. Y'all, be good to one another. Be kind. And God bless.